Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining the West Region Teleconference Series, MS and Stress. Your host for today is Ms. Leanne Bellum. Ms. Bellum, you may begin.
Hi, everyone. Thank you all so much for joining us this evening for our last West Region Teleconference. We are actually moving to a new model of delivery in our next fiscal year, and we'll be joining with our national office to provide teleconferences at a national level with all of the chapters across the country. So this is the last West Region conference we will have. We're very pleased to have you all on the line with us this evening. This is one of the many free and helpful programs and services available to people living with MS through the National MS Society. And we want to encourage you to give the National MS Society a call whenever there is any information or resources you need by calling our 1-800-344-4867 number and pressing option 1. We know that managing stress is a big factor in helping to manage the symptoms of MS, and it is helpful to recognize the signs of stress early and to find strategies to deal with it before it takes over and contributes to the symptoms you may already be experiencing. So we are very excited tonight to hear from Dr. Louisa Levy to learn some of these strategies. Dr. Levy is a neurologist in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, and is affiliated with the Kootenai Neurology Clinic at Kootenai Health. She received her medical degree from the University of Washington School of Medicine, and she is MS fellowship trained at the University of Washington and is also on the clinical faculty at the University of Washington. She has been in practice for about 9 years and specializes in MS as well as general neurology cases. So I will turn the time over to Dr. Levy. Just one quick note, at the end of the teleconference series, you will receive a program evaluation, and the operators will ask you 3 simple questions that you can answer by pressing a number on your phone, and we would love to have your feedback. Thanks again, and here is Dr. Levy.
Thank you so much. Hopefully everyone can hear me okay. I can't hear you, but at the very end of this talk, we will have an opportunity for questions. So I will stop it probably in about 45 minutes and then leave about 15 minutes for questions. So thanks for the introduction. I'm out in Coeur d'Alene, although I have ties to Seattle at the University of Washington. I've been practicing MS for quite a long time. And, you know, when I have to say, when I graduated my fellowship, the data back then was not very strong about MS and stress, and one of the teachings was that stress only caused pseudo-exacerbations, meaning that old symptoms from MS would be brought out whenever you were tired towards the end of the day, if you were working too hard in too much heat. Those are the physical stressors, like just too much heat on your body, but also psychological stress, like a death in the family or some anxiety or depression that might set in, also could help worsen MS, but it was thought that it was just a pseudo-exacerbation. But now, with probably research in the last 10 years or so, it's been thought that MS and stress, actually, there is an association. And this is somewhat of a new research. Sorry, I think I cut out here. In fact, the first description in 1968 was by Dr. Charcot, who felt that MS was actually due to stress, but there was no support for that until recently. So let me go through basically stress. So stress is basically when your brain and immune system interact in a way where balance is threatened, and if that's the case, then your cortisol levels go up, and then when cortisol levels go up, you tend to affect your immune system in a way where things are suppressed.
Hello?
Ladies and gentlemen, please hold. We're trying to get our speaker back on the line. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Louisa Levy.
Sorry about that. And moderators, can you hear me? Because I'm having trouble putting it on speaker. Is this an audible volume?
I can hear you.
Okay, sorry about that. So I'm going to start over. Sorry, I lost my train of thought because I was playing with the phone. So I apologize. So let's start over. So the first case of MS was described in 1968 by Dr. Charcot. And back then, he even noticed the association between stress and MS, but there was no data. And then probably starting about 10 years ago in the 1980s, there was more and more case reports. And the problem with case reports is that they are only just descriptions of single cases, and there was not a certainty that it was applicable to all MS patients. And so really the first well-structured clinical trial actually didn't occur, I think, until 2012, when there was a study looking at MRI brain lesions in MS patients with stress. And it actually showed that patients who had stress, who underwent therapy, actually had an improvement in brain lesions. And so probably looking at the data, there's probably 700-some articles related to MS and stress. And if you look at the top 20 well-designed studies, you start seeing an association, but it's still not clear. I would say the association is probably about as powerful as maybe 20 to 30% in some patients, but in general, we can't make any sort of generalizations about cause. So let's talk about physiologic stresses. So during stress, you actually get a rise in cortisol levels. And you would think that cortisol levels, which is what we get for relapses, would actually help relapses. But in fact, cortisol levels, when you raise them during stress, it seems to actually cause resistance, where cortisol receptors become resistant to the effects of steroids over time. So then with chronic stress, where the body has chronically elevated natural steroids, the steroid hormone receptors actually become desensitized to the effects of steroids. So that's why we think that chronic stress over time may actually worsen MS, because the natural protective steroid effect actually becomes doesn't work as well, because the body becomes resistant to steroids, kind of like insulin resistance in diabetes. So because it's never made sense that during stress, we know that steroid levels rise, it should actually be protective, just like we give steroids during a relapse. So that's been actually the main argument against stress causing MS or worsening it. But then it turns out that chronic stress, which may be physical, which may be psychologic, may be actually environmental, like divorce and things that is outside of your control, probably produces resistance to the effects of steroids. So that's kind of been the biological explanation for why stress might worsen MS. And then if you look at stress and actually the onset of MS, it looks like in about 20-some studies, MS patients, if you look at when they had onset of symptoms in the past year, probably about 70-some percentage of MS patients actually report that they've had a significant loss of a relationship, some sort of illness or some sort of anxiety, depression, or family conflict. Whereas if you look at the average population in the year, only about 30 to 35% of people report that. So it seems like in the year prior to MS onset, to diagnosis, most MS patients have undergone some sort of stress. Now, whether that's a cause is debatable because there's plenty of people who develop MS symptoms for the first time when they've not been undergoing stress, but we do think it's actually a factor. If you look at relapses, relapses seem to follow stressful events. So there was a study that showed that almost half of stressful life events were followed by some worsening of MS symptoms that qualified for a relapse within 6 weeks. And then if you take measurements to kind of prove that someone is in a state of stress, we find that blood pressure is high, heart rate is high, and then there are certain chemicals that are measurable. So it seems like MS relapses can be triggered by stress, but there's also a lot of factors that make it hard to get an accurate picture, because most people after a relapse tend to recall that there is a stress when that might be just a bias. So, for example, most of us, if something like a bad event happened, would probably connect that with an MS relapse when it may be just a recall bias rather than an actual relationship. So if you look at the types of stress, it's not all the same. So short-term stress, less than 2 weeks or so, seem to worsen MS, as well as chronic long-term stress. But if you look at like really, really severe life-threatening stress, so during times of war, for example, air missile attacks in the Gulf War, that sort of thing, there have been studies, numerous case reports showing that when someone's life is threatened, cortisol levels probably rise so, so high that it actually does successfully suppress disease activity. So we think that short-term stress as well as chronic moderate-level stress actually seems to worsen MS, but really, really significant life-changing events that's like life-threatening seem not to and may actually be protective. And animal studies show this as well. So I think most of us have just day-to-day life stress, and that actually probably worsens MS, but chronic long-term stress is probably the worst for MS. Repeated multiple strings of stressors or bad events over months seems to be the worst. So if you look at MRI data, MRI seems to worsen also with stress. And probably there's only been two clean studies on this, which showed that family conflict, loss of a job, or some sort of problem in MS patients, 8 weeks later, they seem to have an increased chance of having active MRI brain lesions. And then the treatment for it, which is some sort of like stress management therapies, actually seem to decrease the number of MRI brain lesions. So what they did was they looked at MS patients, they took half of them and gave them stress management techniques and basically put them in therapy for about 6 months. And during that time, they found that maybe, I think 70-some percentage of those patients were free of gadolinium lesions when they were actively managing their stress. And in the other group, which was not undergoing therapy, that was in a state of stress, actually had more brain lesions by the end of the 6 months. And so it seemed like intervening and learning how to manage stress seemed to decrease the number of brain lesions. But then if you looked at how long that effect lasted, they stopped the therapies, and then 6 months later, they looked at the brain lesions, and then it looked like both groups had gone back to the same activity level. So it seems like therapy and stress management seem to work while you're practicing it, but then after stopping, if your lifestyle goes back to the same previous state, it doesn't seem to be effective at long-term treatment for MS in terms of managing MRI brain lesions. So bottom line is, if you have stress, you do want to manage it. And there's probably, you know, there's many different types of stress. So I think you have to first define the stress as being physical. So I would define the physical stressors as too much heat on your body would be a heat stressor. So you, we use things like cooling vests, staying cool, moderating your activity to in the morning or into the late evening, and then trying to avoid too much activity all at once. So remember that your conduction and your nervous system slows down with heat. And then if you were to cool your body, conduction speeds up. So managing physical stressors like heat sensitivity is really important, because you can actually make your endurance go last longer and do more with proper heat management. And then other physical stressors would be insomnia would be really important, trying to manage the symptoms that keep you up. And so chronic sleep deprivation from insomnia will basically lead to a state of physical stress. And then usually with sleep deprivation, some sort of emotional change, people just don't think as well, they may be more irritable, that sort of thing. So looking at insomnia is really important, whether it's a snoring that's keeping you up or some sort of symptom. Very commonly, bladder keeps people up, some sort of pain keeps people up. So managing nerve pain, muscle spasms, sleep disorders where you snort yourself awake, those are all important, because your brain actually does its, most of its healing in its deepest stages of sleep. And then the other bodily symptoms that present a stress on MS would actually be psychologically. So probably one of the most important things to treat to manage stress is actually depression and anxiety. So there was a study showing that MS patients had more anxiety, and then the MS patients that had the most anxiety, as well as depressive symptoms, scoring higher on these questionnaires, seemed to also have the highest number of disease activity. And that's kind of a chicken and egg phenomenon, where I think if your MS disease control was bad and your MS was very, very active, it probably would create a state of anxiety and depression. But it seems to be independent of that, because if you look at MS patients prior to diagnosis, the ones who are prone to depression and anxiety to begin with, even before their MS started, seem to do not as well. So having more depression and more anxiety seems to predict more relapses. And then certainly, I think if you have a lot of anxiety, what that means is that you may not be coping as well with the symptoms of a relapse. So I think even though treating depression directly doesn't alter the course of MS, I think treating depression, whether it's through counseling, learning how to manage the stressors that cause depression, is really important so that people weather relapses better. And then other bodily stressors would be things like the bladder. So bladder is really tied in with social activities, because there's a lot of embarrassment with incontinence in public. People live by bathrooms. They have apps now, even on iPhones, that actually show you where all the bathrooms are in a city. So, bladder symptoms are really important to control, because they limit your ability to go places, car rides, for example, and they represent a source of infection. And sources of infection in the bladder can increase inflammation and in that way also trigger pseudo-exacerbations. So proper bladder health, which is really important as managing a physical stressor. And in order to manage bladder, there's lots of treatments available. One of them is basically timing your bathroom breaks just so that you're not waiting until the urge strikes, because by the time this urge strikes, it's going to be too late. The other would be managing your fluid intake so that you're not drinking excessive water all throughout the daytime, but actually lumping it more, like with meals, so that you can plan on when to empty your bladder. Usage of medications that calm down the bladder would be important. And then seeing a specialist in urology if you have a lot of frequent urinary tract infections. So stress can't be avoided, but I think coping with stress is really important. So again, depending on the stressors that you're talking about, if you're talking about the common everyday stress, I think everyone would probably cite family relationships, finances, marital conflicts. You know, even pregnancy can be a happy but very stressful event. Changes in jobs, or even changes in where you live, moving to a new place. So all of those represent major changes in life. And every time that happens, your body's gonna undergo changes. So the changes in your body, you can't help that. You can't help the changes in cortisol levels, in kind of your heart rate and your blood pressure and that sort of thing. But you can help how you cope. And so one of the strategies is literally just trying to improve your social network so that you have a good network of friends, a good network of family, people to call on when these life changes happen. It's always a good idea to try to keep in contact with people, keep social, so that you have people to help you, you know, whenever these life changes occur. And then just having a positive attitude also really helps with these psychological stressors. And then in terms of formal coping strategies, it's been shown over and over again that stress management therapy, which is kind of a new trend in MS, it's called SMT. These are actual formal, well-trained therapists who practice what's called cognitive behavioral therapy. And stress management therapists actually meet with patients, almost like counseling for anxiety or depression, meet with patients on weekly or monthly sessions for several months, and then they actually sit down and teach you how to problem solve, how to force your mind to relax, how to distract yourself from the stressor. So rather than stressing about fixing a problem that doesn't seem to be, that you can't seem to fix, you can shift your attention to another problem that has a solution. And so distraction is really important. Distraction, even like leaving a problem for a period of time, can actually help. Restructuring your thought patterns. With people with anxiety just refers to worrying. But then when worrying can be too much, it actually is impairing. A little bit of anxiety is good. It makes you get things done. But too much anxiety, and what happens is, you get paralyzed almost. And then, so restructuring your thought pattern, because things that seem really stressful may not be. And so you actually can reshape how you approach problems, how you rethink. And that's actually called cognitive behavioral therapy. And then the things that would help everyone would be, you know, communication skills, you know, management of all the symptoms that we talked about, and then trying to integrate that into a daily routine, along with physical exercise, along with taking your disease modifying therapies, and along with the routine doctor's visits to make sure your MS is in control. So, let me just review my notes here. So, in terms of stress, let me just recap that. Stress seems to be associated, doesn't seem to be a cause. Similar to vitamin D, there's very, very poor research in the earlier years and stronger research kind of in the more recent years. Still, though, no huge body of research that is strongly supportive. And I would say for every positive report showing an association, there's probably a smaller number that shows that there is no association. So it's still a very controversial subject about whether stress is a cause. I think most people don't think stress is a cause of MS, but there is some association definitely where whether it's psychological, bodily stress can actually exacerbate the number of attacks that you have, can sometimes even increase the number of spots that you have on the brain scan. It doesn't seem to be a prolonged effect, but it seems to be at least within 6 to 8 weeks of any sort of stressor. And if you look at stress and then first symptom onset, it seems like most, at least half of MS patients in some of these studies have reported that they had a stressor within a year before their diagnosis or symptom onset. And then also remember, not all stress is the same. Some really, really extreme life-threatening stressors seem to be beneficial in temporarily suppressing the disease. Short-term stress seems to exacerbate, but chronic, moderate stress, like long-term, seems to be the worst. And then there's been other, I didn't mention, but there's been other studies showing that physical trauma doesn't seem to worsen stress. For example, they looked at head concussions and skull fractures, broken arms and broken legs. Physical trauma from those, like injuries, don't seem to have any impact on either making MS better or worse. And then there's also such a thing as positive stress. And positive stress would be like a wedding, something that's stressful in terms of planning, but also a positive event. Childbirth, for example, can be stressful financially, et cetera, but it's still an overall positive thing. Those things do not seem to increase either MS brain lesions or relapses. And then MS in itself is stressful. So having MS causes the stress of just having the illness, because you have to kind of modify your life around the MS symptoms to accommodate it. And so that can be stressful to a lot of people. And for example, you know, losing some function in a leg and having to use a cane or a walker. That's actually a very stressful time to make that transition to needing a walker, for example. But if you look at that sort of stressor, it actually doesn't seem to worsen the MS itself. So stress of the illness rather than an external environmental stress seems not to worsen MS. And so otherwise it would be a vicious cycle where as patients got worse and progressed over time, if that stressor worsened MS, you would think that it would be a vicious cycle and that people would continue to worsen and slide downhill just from the stressors of the illness. And that's been looked at, and it seems to be independent of the stressors from having the disease itself. But certainly individual symptoms can add up and accumulate to lead to anxiety and depression, chronic sleep deprivation, and that sort of thing. And so it's still important to treat all the symptoms of MS. And then in terms of the strategies, it's hard to go through specific strategies for stress management because everyone's life is so different and everyone has such a different type of stress. But basically, probably the most useful stress management is going to be looking at how you deal with stress, how you cope. Your personality, I think, will determine that, and also whether you tend to cope in a positive, constructive way or whether you cope by kind of reflecting and becoming irritable, for example. You have to kind of change your coping strategy so that it's a more positive and drawing your attention away from the negatives of the stress seems to be really helpful. So there's been lots and lots of questionnaires at MS patients looking at which ones do better, which ones don't do as well. And there's definitely a trend towards people who are more positive, people who tend not to let stress get them down, people who seem to bounce back after setbacks, that sort of thing, seem to do better, at least in their perception of the disease. So, for example, someone in a wheelchair may actually have a more positive outlook than someone who is newly diagnosed without a physical disability that you can even tell, because it's all in the head. Someone with MS going on for 20 years just learns to manage it, learns how to deal with it, still does everything that they want, and they don't perceive their MS as being a setback. They don't perceive their MS as holding them back. If you were to ask that person and do a depression scale or anxiety scale, it actually will score lower than someone who is newly diagnosed, say, at the age of 20, who had all these plans in life, and with the diagnosis in their head, they think that it means that they have to give up everything, that they can't have a family, they can't have a job or something. And so the perception of your disease is really, really important. And so that actually ties in strongly with how likely you are to fall into depression, how likely you are to be anxious about your disease. And so I think the changing your perception of MS, taking each stressor in stride, knowing that you can come back from it, those are actually really important, because in the long term, those acceptance and learning how to cope probably does decrease those biomarkers of MS, meaning your cortisol levels, your blood pressure. So I think it does have a physiologic impact on your MS. So that's pretty much the summary on stress. And then it looks like we have a few minutes. We can open it up for questions, or I could talk more in generalities about specific stressors in detail. If people want to ask about specific physical symptoms as it relates to stress, that's fine. We could talk about management of those things. We could talk about any individual questions as well, so that if you guys have about yourself. So could we open it up for questions?
Yes, ma'am. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, if there is any questions that you have, please press the number 1 key on your phone. Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press the number 1 key on your phone. Our first question is from Michelle. Michelle, go ahead.
Hi. I was wondering, I've been reading about meditation helping with MS. Do you think that's one of the self-management tools?
Yeah, definitely. So, and in fact, I think the meditation is essentially the same as mindfulness, and which encompasses meditation. So there's lots and lots of data. It's looking more at mindfulness. And mindfulness is actually kind of like meditating, but also a strategy to approach how you think and being kind of in the present, that sort of thing. So there is, and it's probably not looked at as much as cognitive behavioral therapy, but mindfulness is definitely up and coming as one of the ways to manage stress. So, you know, I think if you were to see a therapist with some background in mindfulness, that actually could be incorporated, and you could probably fuse some of these different ways of learning stress management. And I don't think it matters which one you use, because I think it just suits whichever one suits your personality and your patience level. Some people probably who are more high-strung and more active and want kind of checklists of things to do, may have a hard time sometimes with learning meditation if it doesn't fit your personality. But for others who are interested in being more thoughtful, being more mindful, that actually would be a very good way to treat stress. And there is actually studies looking at MS and mindfulness, but it's kind of very, very small, not a lot of data, but I think it seems to be effective.
Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have any questions, please press the number one key on your phone. There are no further, I'm sorry, one moment. Our next question is from Stephanie. Stephanie, go ahead.
Hi, I'm a child of a person with MS. My mother has it, and she's got it pretty extensively. She has about 72 active lesions right now, and she has a really, really hard time with the stress management, and I'm wondering if there's any resources out there as, you know, as a caregiver or somebody, you know, that cares about her.
Yeah.
For me to kind of help her?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. So is she mobile? Like, can she get around on her own, or is she needing a lot of help?
She is. It's kind of 50-50. It depends.
Like, can she
right
drive?
Now.
Okay.
Yes, yes. Not
okay.
Very well sometimes, but she
yeah.
does drive.
So, and how far along is she in the diagnosis? Like, she had it for 5 years, 10 years, 20 years?
Well, she was diagnosed in 2008, but we believe that she had it
okay.
much longer.
So it's still pretty new. She's within 10 years of diagnosis. So she may still have some trouble with adjusting to it. And is she has she gone into treatment right away, or does she wait?
No, she went into treatment immediately.
Right away.
She
okay.
was actually diagnosed with the fibromyalgia beforehand, and
yeah.
we came
okay.
to find out, you
so,
know, that it was a misdiagnosis.
Yeah, if she jumped on treatment right away, that at least that helps. But, you know, to have untreated MS for 5-10 years, you know, is a lot to battle, and then to suddenly be diagnosed, it's just a lot to overcome in terms of trying to get the disease under control and then trying to cope with the symptoms that have accumulated and then trying to deal with the stress of it. So I think for her, you know, definitely you want to address all of the bodily symptoms for sure. In someone with that many 70-plus lesions, you actually would want to get the lesions to turn the corner and to stop being so active. You want them to be treated adequately. If she's symptomatic, like with the, you know, we sometimes do steroids, she needs to be on a effective disease-modifying therapy, so like one of the injectables, one of the orals, Tysabri, whatever the therapy is, she needs to start taking that to address the disease so that the disease doesn't continue to worsen. Because if you have stress and then the disease continuing to worsen, it's going to be, you know, just a lot to deal with. And then managing all of her symptoms. So, you know, asking your mom, what are the top three things that bother her? So, because you can't list all of them and address all of them, but find out if there's pain, find out if there's anxiety, find out if there's depression, find out if there's like a bladder issue, and I would treat the bodily symptoms. And then when that is all treated with some either physical therapy or whatever, or medication, then I would actually get her to see a therapist. And
yeah, because we actually do have her symptoms. I mean, she has a baclofen pump implanted.
Yeah.
She's on the Gilenya.
Yeah.
And, you know, she does, she's very good about, you know, trying to get her symptoms under control.
Yeah.
But it's just, I know,
just
you know.
Coping
and,
psychologically with it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So then she needs a therapist. I mean, rather than throwing a medicine at it, like, say, an antidepressant, which you can, sometimes for mobility issues, some people just cannot physically get out to see a therapist every week. Therapists usually don't make home visits. So sometimes there is no option to go out once a week to a therapist's office because there's mobility issues or transportation issues, in which case then your best bet is then an antidepressant or to help with depression and anxiety or some sort of a way to teach her to cope. And so that means making sure she has a good social network, you know, and that sort of thing. Distraction, you may have to, you know, like help her to learn some of these coping mechanisms, get her hobbies and things that she's interested in, so that she doesn't focus on the symptoms of MS. And then, but if you have the ability to get her to a therapist, I would actually find a psychologist or a master's level therapist to do some type of cognitive behavioral therapy.
Okay, thank you.
Those help. And, you know, the CBT training sessions are not indefinite for the rest of your life. You actually go through, usually it's like a 6-month, a certain number of sessions, they teach you the the tools, and then you actually apply them. You learn to apply them. You get supervision as you apply them. And then it's meant to restructure you so that it can change you. And people who successfully complete CBT can actually stay off of antidepressants or stay off of anxiety medicines. Whereas if you start with an antidepressant, if you don't change the way you think, change the way you deal with stress, then you're kind of stuck on the antidepressant indefinitely. So CBT would be probably the best route of to cure it or to find some way of coping so that she doesn't have to be on the medicine.
Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have any questions, please press the number 1 key on your phone. Our next question is from Mike. Mike, go ahead.
Yes, I had symptoms since I was a child. I'm 61 now. I was diagnosed 20 years ago, and I've had bad episodes, and then I had times where I was okay, but I found that I function in periods where I was using marijuana. I was de-stressed, my bowels worked better, my mind focused better, I was walking better, and I just wondered, when I don't use it, I'm not as good. So I was just wondering what your take was on using that herb.
Yeah, so it depends on what the function is. So I think medical marijuana definitely helps pain, especially of a neuropathic pain. It definitely helps muscle spasms and stiffness. And so, you know, sometimes you hit a wall with baclofen, you can't go any higher, and you're kind of at the limit of what you can do in terms of muscle relaxants and stretching and Botox, for example. And so kind of very short intermittent bursts of marijuana can actually help to spasticity. But if you put it all together, it does actually help anxiety, but in terms of anxiety, it's a little counterproductive, because what we know about marijuana and the mood is that when you're under the effects of it, you may feel calm. You may feel like you don't care about this, and it generates a little bit of an apathy in the sense that things don't bother you as well. But it's not really constructive, because when the effects wear off, you're back to your old way of thinking, you know, in terms of cognitively, and you get you tend to get rebound anxiety. You tend to get rebounds off of it, where you kind of start needing the marijuana if that's your only mode of treating anxiety. So I'd say marijuana, a lot of people use marijuana to self-medicate for anxiety. It works in the short term, intermittently, but long term it actually leads to kind of problems. So it depends on so my take on medical marijuana is I like to be very clear on what you're trying to treat. If you're trying to treat muscle spasms, if you're trying to treat pain that's refractory to everything else, yes. In cancer patients, if you're trying to use it to maintain weight because they've lost so much weight from chemo and the cancer itself, there's a lot of positives for the marijuana. But if you're using it as a treatment of anxiety, I have not seen that to be successful. I've seen that it, in the long run, is counterproductive, and there's too much rebound coming on and on it, coming off of it, that sort of thing. So I think in the right hands, with the right diagnosis, this could be very helpful. And then the other thing about medical marijuana is that not all strains are necessarily the same. And so a lot of places where marijuana is legal, for example, in Washington, in Seattle, there are research into subtypes of strains that might be better, for example, for spasticity, or some strains that are bred that are better for nerve pain. And then most of the medical marijuana that's bred and in a lot of these kind of certified places, actually purposely lower the THC compounds that actually lead to cognitive dulling. So, you know, the high that you get, the grogginess, you can actually find strains that minimize that. And so if you're going to use medical marijuana in that way, I would recommend getting the strains that minimize the cognitive dulling effects of marijuana, and that they do exist, but you may have to go to kind of bigger cities where there's an organization. A lot of smaller rural communities just don't have an organization that that, you know, can grow different strains of marijuana. And it's not legal in every state. It's not legal in Idaho, for example. It's legal in Washington only. So it's hard. It's hard for people to get.
Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have any questions, please press the number one key on your phone. There are no further questions in queue. Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have any questions, please press 1. Our next question is from Teddy.
Yeah. So what are the advantages of using social media as a support group?
Yeah, I think it's a good way to stay connected. So social media, in my mind, means, you know, Twitter or Facebook and that sort of thing, and even texting. And I think it's good to be able to stay in touch, but it probably is not as healthy if it's replacing actual physical social, interaction. So seeing people and meeting people is probably a healthier kind of way of improving your social network rather than just doing it electronically. Because, lots of people on Facebook can have 100 friends, but how many of them are going to come over and help you, with something in your house if you ran into trouble? So the problem with media, you can spend a lot of time getting to know people electronically through Twitter, Facebook, but will they actually be the people who help you? So you have to have a balance. And so I think too much of that is probably counterproductive, could probably isolate you. And so, there are lots and lots of people who just spend all of their time on the computer or on their phone, but don't actually get out and do things with other people. And so actually forming physical contact is good. And when you have positive human interactions, they actually change your physiology. So having a good human interaction is going to be kind of the opposite of a stressful interaction, which can raise your blood pressure and, increase steroid levels and increase interleukins and chemicals. So I'd say it's a good option for people who have problems getting out, but I would still say joining a local community group or a church or something like that is probably just a healthier, because you get also out of the house, walking, and some physical activity from that type of social activity, other than just sitting on a couch in front of a computer or something.
Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have any questions, please press the number one key on your phone. Dr. Levy, there are no further questions in queue.
Okay, thank you. And I think there are is a request for people to stay on the phone for a questionnaire or some sort of poll afterwards.
Yes, ma'am. There is a polling session. Did you have any closing remarks for our parties?
No, and thank you for tuning in for this. And hopefully it was helpful in some way. So thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, please hold on the line while we begin our polling session. Our first question, I have learned how to recognize the signs of stress. Press 1 for yes, 2 for somewhat, 3 for no, or 4 for not sure. Again, I have learned how to recognize the signs of stress. Press 1 for yes, 2 for somewhat, 3 for no, and 4, not sure. Please hold where we prepare our next question. Our second question. I have learned new strategies to help reduce stress. Press 1 for yes, 2 for somewhat, 3 for no, or 4, not sure. I have learned new strategies to help reduce stress. Press 1 for yes, 2 for somewhat, 3 for no, or 4, not sure.
The poll is now closed for this question. Please hold while we prepare our final question. Final question. I have learned to distinguish the difference between stress and depression. Press 1 for yes, 2 for somewhat, 3 for no, or 4 for not sure. Again, I have learned to distinguish the difference between stress and depression. Press 1 for yes, 2 for somewhat, 3 for no, or 4 not sure. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This concludes your polling session. And if Dr. Lavie does not have any closing remarks, ladies and gentlemen, you may all disconnect. This concludes today's teleconference.